Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 246, being recorded on August 27th of the year 2000. This is an update on America's political assassinations, and we're going to launch right into the subject, and bear in mind that archive shows and other For the Record segments have information which will overlap the information you hear here and supplement it. We're going to launch right in with an article from the New York Times of Thursday, May 18th of the year 2000. This details the charging of two suspects in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in April of 1963. This bombing had much to do with focusing anger and public sentiment over the civil rights movement in the American South. It also, as we will hear, has tie-ins with the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. This article is by Kevin Sack, last name S-A-C-K. It's headlined, Two Charged in 1963 Church Blast That Killed Four Birmingham Girls. The article is subheaded, Hint of New Testimony, but No Details Are Given, Dateline to Birmingham, Alabama. It reads in part as follows. Nearly 37 years after a bombing that horrified the nation, the authorities here have charged two longtime suspects with murder in the deaths of four black girls in the explosion of Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church. Thomas E. Blanton Jr. and Bobby Frank Cherry, both of whom were affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan and have been considered suspects for decades, turned themselves in this morning after being indicted by a state grand jury on Tuesday. They are being held in the Jefferson County Jail here without bond. Only one man, Robert Chambliss, has ever been tried for the 1963 bombing, and that was not until 1977. Skipping down in the article, remember Robert Chambliss, by the way. We're going to come back to the individual who represented him in court. About the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, we read, The church had been a center of civil rights activity in Birmingham, a city that experienced some of the most violent resistance of the day. Perhaps as much as any single act, the bombing aroused public sentiment against Southern segregationists and emboldened civil rights leaders to redouble their efforts. More recently, the incident was the subject of Spike Lee's acclaimed documentary, Four Little Girls. By the way, I want to correct myself. The 16th Street Baptist Church bombing was on September 15th of 1963. It was not in April of that particular month. Now, this might seem, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing might seem to be a little bit far from home for a discussion about America's political assassinations, but in fact, we've touched on the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in a number of broadcasts in the past, specifically in RFA 13, and The Guns of November, Part 4. We touched on it to a certain extent in For the Record Program 191. And as you're going to hear, we discussed the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing at considerable length in Radio Free America Program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King. That was recorded on April 4th of 1985, the 17th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. Now, one of James Earl Ray's attorneys, in fact, his first attorney, and an individual who secured a guilty plea from James Earl Ray in exchange for a promise of the profits from a book by William Bradford Huey about Ray's supposed killing of Martin Luther King. Ray reversed his plea a couple of days later, but was never able to gain a new trial. That attorney was a man named Arthur Haynes. Arthur Haynes was the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, when that city was the focal point of civil rights activity. He turned its sheriff, Sheriff John Bull Connor, loose on the civil rights demonstrators who attacked them with police dogs and fire hoses. And later, Arthur Haynes, who had been an FBI agent who quit the FBI because he considered its policy too liberal, he thought the civil rights movement was a communist-inspired movement. Arthur Haynes had also worked as a contract agent for the Central Intelligence Agency in the Bay of Pigs invasion. Arthur Haynes, as I said, represented Robert Chambliss in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. That's discussed in Radio Free America Program 13, The Guns of November, Part 4, and in RFA Number 8. Others of James Earl Ray's attorneys have connections running in the direction of the assassination of John Kennedy. Percy Foreman, a lawyer for the reactionary Hunt family in Texas, was Jack Ruby's attorney at one point. Others of James Earl Ray's attorneys were Mark Lane, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the investigation into the assassination of John Kennedy, and also a fellow named Jesse Stoner, or J.B. Stoner, the head of the National States Rights Party, an American racist Marxist and Fascist Party, one of whose members was Jerry Ray, James Earl Ray's brother. Jerry Ray was a bodyguard for J.B. Stoner. Now, a member of the National States Rights Party named Joseph Adams Miltier, whom, as we've looked at in discussion with the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, was attending a reactionary, a domestic fascist conference called the Congress of Freedom in New Orleans in the spring of 1963. Members of that organization were, included high-ranking military officers in its membership. That organization was discussing in the spring of 1963 assassinating American political figures as part of a necessary moving of the American of the United States to the right. Now, note in the section you're about to hear, which is a reading of a transcript of an interview that an undercover Miami police informant had with Mr. Miltier. This was on November 10th of 1963, 12 days before President Kennedy was assassinated, and it discusses a plan to kill President Kennedy, which in its superficial aspects is very similar to to the official version of Kennedy being assassinated. It also links this with a plot against Dr. King's life and with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. As we've noted in a number of other broadcasts, including For the Record program number 104, there are a number of different evidentiary tributaries connecting the assassination of Martin Luther King and that of the Kennedy brothers. This, once again, is from RFA program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King. It's recorded on April 4th, of 1985, more than 15 years ago. And in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Now, one of the interesting things about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and we've talked about some connecting links between that crime and the assassination of President Kennedy, is that there is an interesting transcript which links the assassination of Martin Luther King to the assassination of John Kennedy, and also links it to the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. That bombing, in which four young black girls were killed, was one of the focal points of the struggle for civil rights in the South during the 1960s, and eventually a couple of Klansmen were convicted in that crime. We're going to talk some more about that. But in order to approach the discussion of James Earl Ray's lawyers and their curious handling of his situation, it might be good to take what we're going to do really is to take a look at a portion of this transcript. Now, this transcript was recorded in Miami. It was recorded by an undercover Miami police informant in an interview with a man named Joseph Adams Miltier, last name Miltier. Now, Miltier was the Georgia representative for the National States Rights Party. The States Rights Party was headed by Jesse Stoner, J.B. Stoner, one of James Earl Ray's attorneys. Now, this transcript took place on November 10th. The interview, I should say, took place on November 10th of 1963, a full 2 weeks before President Kennedy was killed almost. Yet the information contained herein has never really been dealt with by the authorities. Part of a massive body of information that points to a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy that has been disregarded. Now, this particular transcript has come up in a number of different places. It, first of all, was published in a book called Frame Up. That is a book about the killing of Martin Luther King. That was authored by a researcher named Harold Weisberg, last name Weisberg, published in hardcover by Outerbridge and Dienstfree, Dienstfrey, distributed by E.P. Dutton, copyrighted 1969 by Weisberg. If you can't find the book Frame Up, this same transcript is also contained in a book called The Assassinations, subtitled Dallas and Beyond. That's an anthology about some of the key assassination literature, edited by Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, Paul L. Hoch, last name H-O-C-H, and Russell Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R, copyrighted 1976 and soft cover by the Vintage Press. And we're going to read you a portion of this transcript. Now, remember, before dealing with the section we're actually going to read you here, that there is a lot of discussion before the part we're going to read you about the involvement of some of these far-right wingers in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Again, a key
focal point in the struggle for civil rights in the 60s, and one of the most outrageous acts that was performed against those fighting on behalf of civil rights. And as we're going to see, there are connecting links between the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the assassination of President Kennedy. Recall that this is a conversation between Joseph Adams Miltier, Georgia representative of the National States Rights Party, headed by James Earl Ray, one of James Earl Ray's lawyers, Jesse Stoner, and an undercover Miami police informant. This is on November 10th, 1963.
Informant. I don't know. I think Kennedy is coming here on the 18th or something like that to make some kind of speech. I don't know what it is, but I imagine it will be on TV. And you can be on the look for that. I think it is the 18th that he's supposed to be here. I don't know what it's supposed to be about. Subject. In this case, Miltier. You can bet your bottom dollar he's going to have a lot to say about the Cubans. There are so many of them here. Informant. Yeah, well, he will have 1,000 bodyguards. Don't worry about that. Subject. The more bodyguards he has, the easier it is to get him. Informant. What? Subject. The more bodyguards he has, the more easier it is to get him. Informant. Well, how in the hell do you figure would be the best way to get him? Subject. From an office building with a high-powered rifle. How many people, then there's room noise and the tape is not legible for a moment, does he have going around who look just like him? Do you know about that? Informant. No, I never heard that he had anybody. Subject. He has got them. Informant. He has? Subject. He has about 15. Whenever he goes any place, they... Not legible. He knows he is a marked man. Informant. You think he knows he is a marked man? Subject. Sure he does. Informant. They are really going to try to kill him? Subject. Oh, yeah, it is in the working. Brown himself. Brown is just as likely to get him as anybody. He hadn't said so, but he tried to get Martin Luther King. Informant. He did. Subject. Oh, yes, he followed him for miles and miles and couldn't get close enough to him. Informant. You know exactly where it is in Atlanta, don't you? Subject. Martin Luther King. Yeah. Informant. Bustis Street. That's a phonetic approximation. Subject. Yeah, 530. Informant. Oh, Brown tried to get him, huh? Subject. Yeah. Informant. Well, he will damn sure do it, I will tell you that. Well, that is why, look, you see, well, that is why we have to be so careful, you know, that Brown is operating strong. Subject. He ain't going for play, you know. Informant. That is right. Subject. He's going for broke.
Okay, before continuing with the transcript, recall that in the section Niptuck just read you, there is a description of a plan to kill President Kennedy by disassembling a high-powered rifle and bringing it up into an office building. More about that will be described here in the section I'm going to read you. That, of course, is the official version of what happened to President Kennedy. Now, whether or not shots actually were fired from the Texas School Book Depository, there's a fair amount of controversy about that. It has been definitely established by all who are willing to examine the facts of the situation that the fatal shots were not fired from the Texas School Book Depository, but rather from the Grassy Knoll and a number of other places in Dealey Plaza. But the official version of the Kennedy assassination maintains that a high-powered rifle was fired from an office building after having been allegedly disassembled by Lee Harvey Oswald. Continuing now with the transcript. Informant. I never asked Brown about his business or anything. You know, he just told us, you know. But after the conversation and the way he talked to us, there is no question in my mind who knocked off the church in Birmingham. You can believe that. That is the way I figured it. Subject. That is right. It is about the only way you can figure it. Informant. That is right. Subject. Not being there. Not knowing anything. Informant. But just from his conversation, as you and me know him, but if they did, it is their business, like you say. Subject. It is up to the individual. Informant. That is right. They are individual operators. We don't want that within the party. Hitting this Kennedy is going to be a hard proposition. I tell you, I believe you may have figured out a way to get him. You may have figured out the office building and all that. I don't know how them Secret Service agents cover all them office buildings or anywhere he is going. Do you know whether they do that or not? Subject. Well, if they have any suspicion, they do that, of course. But without suspicion, chances are they wouldn't. You take there in Washington, of course it is the wrong time of the year, but you take pleasant weather. He comes out on the veranda, and somebody could be in a hotel room across the way there and pick him off just like... The tape fades out at that point. Informant, is that right? Subject, sure. Disassemble a gun. You don't have to take a gun up there. You can take it up in pieces. All those guns come knocked down. You can take them apart. Interrupting again here before Nip/Tuck finishes up this section of transcript, that the description of the plan to kill Kennedy that was just given also would fit the scenario for the Martin Luther King assassination, in which, I recall, Dr. King was out on a balcony talking to his chauffeur, and the fatal shot was then fired from either the hotel itself, the motel room, or from a clump of bushes just below that motel room window. So that we were seeing foreshadowing here of a number of crimes which did in fact occur, and of course linked to the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham.
Okay, informant. They have got a damn... This boy was telling me yesterday about they have got an explosive that you get out of the Army. It is supposed to be like putty or something. You stick it up and use a small fuse. You just stick it like that, he told me. And I think this is what happened in the church in Birmingham. They stuck this stuff. Somebody stuck it under the steps with a short fuse and went on home. Informant. This boy is pretty smart. Demolition, is that what you call it? Subject. Demolition. That is right. Informant. I am going to talk with him some more. Subject. Yeah, I would. Informant. I am going to talk with him some more and find out a lot more about his operation because he knows a hell of a lot. Subject, you need a guy like that around, too, where we can put our finger on him when we want him. Informant. Yeah, well, you have got somebody up there in that country now, if you need him. Subject, well, we are going to have to get nasty first. In a section that's illegible. Informant, yeah, get nasty. Subject, we have got to be ready. We have got to be sitting on go, too. Informant, yeah, that is right. Subject, there ain't any countdown to it. We have just got to be sitting on go. Countdown, they can move in on you. And on go, they can't. Countdown is all right for a slow, prepared operation. But in an emergency operation, you have got to be sitting on go. Informant, boy, if that Kennedy gets shot, we have got to know where we are at. Because you know that will be a real shake if they do that. Subject. They wouldn't leave any stone unturned there, no way. They will pick up somebody within hours afterwards, if anything like that would happen, just to throw the public off. Informant. Oh, somebody is going to have to go to jail if he gets killed.
And that, again, from Radio Free America, program number 8, from April 4th of 1985. In addition to my own voice, you heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip/Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Note that in addition to discussing plotting against the life of both Martin Luther King and John Kennedy and foreshadowing of the official versions of those two assassinations, that tape links those two impending crimes with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, a couple of suspects in which were just indicted. Note the following too, in connection with For the Record program number 191, updating the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've also talked about that in other recent For the Record programs, including one from early 1999. This from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, May 23rd of the year 2000. This is an AP story, Dateline Union City, Tennessee, headlined Lloyd Jowers Claimed a Role in King's Death. And this is the obituary of Lloyd Jowers. It reads in part as follows. Lloyd Jowers, the former Memphis cafe owner who claimed he hired someone other than James Earl Ray to assassinate the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., has died. He was 73. Mr. Jowers had lung cancer and recently suffered a heart attack, said his lawyer, Lewis K. Garrison. He died Saturday at Baptist Memorial Hospital after lapsing into a coma. Mr. Jowers ran Jim's Grill, a cafe on the ground floor of a rooming house from which prosecutors say the shot that killed King was fired on April 4th of 1968. Ray confessed to the killing in 1969, but recanted and spent the rest of his life trying to prove his innocence. He died in prison in 1998. In an ABC TV interview in 1993, Mr. Jowers said he received $100,000 from late Memphis produce merchant Frank Liberto to arrange King's murder. He claimed he hired the assassin, but said it wasn't Ray. Mr. Jowers and, quote, unknown conspirators, unquote, were found liable in December in a wrongful death lawsuit brought by Mr. Jowers against the slain civil rights leader's family. However, that lawsuit and other massive amounts of other evidence that there was, in fact, a conspiracy behind the assassination of Martin Luther King have had no impact on the official status of the case, at least as far as the Justice Department is concerned. The following is from the New York Times of June 10th of the year 2000, an article by David Johnston. It's headlined, Investigation Finds No Plot in Killing of Dr. King. It's datelined Washington and reads in part, After an 18-month investigation, the Justice Department today concluded that there was no evidence to support recent assertions of a plot to assassinate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and recommended no further inquiry in the case. That, by the way, despite a story that broke just 2 days before that case. This from the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, June 8th of the year 2000. Article by Timothy R. Brown of the AP, dateline Jackson, Mississippi, and headlined, Suspect Indicted in 1966 Murder Retrial. It reads in part, The latest effort to seek justice for crimes dating to Mississippi's civil rights struggle involves a murder that authorities say may have been part of a larger plot to kill the Reverend Martin Luther King. Ernest H. Avance, A-V-A-N-T-S, 69, was indicted Wednesday by a federal grand jury in the murder of black farm worker Ben Chester White on June 10, 1966. Skipping down, the case was closed after Avance's acquittal, but reopened in November after the ABC News program 2020 reported that White's murder took place on federal property. The news program said one of the white men confessed to police that White's slaying was orchestrated in the hopes that it would bring civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. to the area so that he could be assassinated. That just 2 months, two days, that story broke 2 days before the Justice Department report was broken to the news media. The assassination of Robert Kennedy also has many evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of our other political assassinations, including that of his brother, and the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the shooting of George Wallace. We've looked at that in, among other programs, RFA number 9. And the assassination of Robert Kennedy, too, is a case the finding in which continues to face legal challenges. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, May 26th of the year 2000. This is in the National Report section of the Chronicle. It's dateline Los Angeles and reads in part, Saran Saran requests retrial in Kennedy case, and it reads in part as follows. Lawyers for convicted assassin Saran Saran demanded a new trial in federal court yesterday, one day after the California Supreme Court rejected a similar request. In a petition nearly 300 pages long, Saran's attorney said his client is innocent of the 1968 slaying of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who was shot to death moments after declaring victory in the California presidential primary. Quote, The prosecution's entire case was based upon fraudulent evidence, unquote, said attorney Lawrence Teeter, again quoting, that's T-E-E-T-E-R, by the way, again quoting, overwhelming physical evidence of multiple shooters, extra bullets and extra guns was systematically destroyed by the police. Witnesses were intimidated. Physical evidence was altered or substituted. Unquote. By the way, that's all very well documented. In RFA 9, we spoke about that. Note that Manuel Pena and Enrique Hank Hernandez, two LAPD officers of Latino extraction and with documented ties to the CIA and other intelligence services, were in charge of the, quote, investigation, unquote, and note the quotes. More on Saran's petition, this from the L.A. Times of that same day, Friday, May 26th of the year 2000. This is an article by David Rosenzweig of the L.A. Times headlined, Saran Challenges Conviction, and this reads in part as follows. A day after being turned down by the California Supreme Court, Saran Saran filed a petition in Los Angeles federal court Thursday challenging his conviction of the 1968 assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Saran contends that Los Angeles police and prosecutors altered, destroyed, and suppressed evidence that would have cleared him of the crime. Among other claims, his habeas corpus petition says that police substituted a fake bullet for the one recovered from Kennedy's neck, and that prosecutors covered up evidence that a second gunman was involved. Evidence of a second gunman was lost forever, he says, when police destroyed ceiling panels and a door frame which may have been hit by gunfire. Saran also contends that he was poorly represented at his trial because his lawyer, the late Grant Cooper, refused to investigate the possibility that he was hypnotically programmed to kill Kennedy without being able to recall the event afterwards. Skipping down, Saran, now 57 and housed at Corcoran State Prison, maintains he is innocent and suffers from amnesia about all events on the night of Kennedy's murder. I would note that in RFA number 9 and RFA 6, we deal with the issue of mind control in the assassination of Saran. Saran, and the evidence is quite good that he was placed under mind control and that he was, in fact, a patsy. I would note that the entry of the Saran family into the United States was sponsored by a couple of college chums and political allies of Richard Nixon, and that the person most researchers identify as the assassin, a fellow named Thane Eugene Caesar, was working as a security guard in the Ambassador Hotel, also worked for Lockheed, and the security director for Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign was a guy named James Golden, who was on leave from his position as director of security for Lockheed. The son of John F. Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr., died under ambiguous circumstances in the summer of 1999. We've talked about indications that John Kennedy Jr.'s plane may have been sabotaged or that foul play may have been involved in his death. That is discussed in For the Record program number 175 in an interview with John Bryan. Please note the following from the New York Times of Tuesday, June 20th of the year 2000. AP story dateline Washington. It's headlined, John Kennedy Jr. Received Threats, FBI Files Show. It reads in part as follows, skipping down. Speaking of threats against John F. Kennedy Jr., the last came in 1995 when someone called the FBI in New York offering information about a plot to kidnap Mr. Kennedy in New York City, a July 13, 1995 report said. The caller told the FBI that plotters, quote, had determined that Kennedy rode a bicycle in Manhattan and did not have any bodyguards, unquote, it said. And still more about the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. This from the New York Times of Saturday, June 24th of the year 2000. This is an article by Matthew L. Wall, Dateline Washington, and headline, Safety Board Still Studying Kennedy Crash. It reads in part, investigators at the National Transportation Safety Board writing a report about the crash that killed John F. Kennedy Jr., his wife, and his sister-in-law last summer have not found a mechanical problem with his plane, but the staff has yet to reach a conclusion about the crash, according to people at the agency. And we have looked at the discrepancies in the evidence about the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. What's most significant is that the electronic media reported that John F. Kennedy Jr. was being widely discussed as a possible member of the ticket for the Democratic presidential race in the year 2000. That would have placed him in the race against George W. Bush. And please note, the numerous connections of George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We've spoken about that in numerous programs, including For the Record segments 223, 236, and 244, and also in RFA 37 and Miscellaneous Archive Show M20. I've alluded to various programs that are available from a tape duplication called Spitfire. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address is mail@spitfirelist.com, and you can visit the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com, and a matching list of program descriptions on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. That concludes For the Record program number 246. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2000. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.